strong caveat to this, which is there are certain jobs where this is possible. Equally, I mean, you know, we should be very mindful. There is other professions, you know, whether it be nursing or teaching, where it may not be possible that people can actually only work four days a week. So, you know, but these are important conversations we need to have. We need to think about how we change society. We made some big structural changes to society the last time around in the Industrial Revolution. We introduced unions and labor laws and a welfare state and all of these things, and universal education, so we educated for whatever the new jobs were going to be, to ensure that we all prospered. And I think we have to think equally radically this time again, because it's going to be another radical transformation with the additional challenge that this time it's going to be that much quicker. It's definitely unfolding at a much quicker rate.
And possibly more radical, very briefly, possibly more radical, because it's about the way we think, about the way the machines think, and not just about the way they produce stuff.
It is, because last time it was our muscles, and then that still left us with our brain power. This time it's the last thing that makes us special, which is our brain power. So yes, potentially very, very transformative. But I think the solution is not to make us more robotic and more like the art of intelligence, but to focus on the things that make us more human.
Like these conversations on LBC, messy but enlightening. Professor Toby Walsh, thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme. In the next hour, we're going to talk about the defence review, and we're going to talk about the Tories. Are they, as the Prime Minister suggests, facing the abyss and extinction? And Reform UK, are they up to replacing the Tories? And how? Do they even know how the numbers add up? Because their latest budget, according to some critics of it, their latest budget proposals, make Liz Truss's economic programme look like sensible economics. I'm Matt Fry. This is LBC. The time is 11 o'clock.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, two adults and a teenager have died after a car crash on the M5 in South Gloucestershire. Police say a white BMW left the northbound carriageway just after 9 o'clock last night. Our reporter Thea Rickard is following developments for LBC.
Avon and Somerset police believe the three victims were travelling in the car which came off the motorway, a white BMW, alongside another child who was seriously injured and has been taken to hospital. The M5 has remained closed in both directions between junctions 14 and 13 since the crash, with what officers have told us is a very complex scene to investigate.
The Defence Secretary John Healey says he has no doubt that the UK's military spending will reach 3% of national income by 2034. Mr Healey's told a newspaper that the target's no longer an ambition but a certainty. A government source says the Defence Secretary's comments are his opinion and not a new commitment. Two men have been arrested on suspicion of murder after another man's body was found in a garden in Exmouth in Devon. Police were called to reports of a man who had been assaulted at a property in Ashfield Close in the early hours of this morning. Canada's High Commissioner in the UK has told LBC his country will respond appropriately to Donald Trump's latest tariff announcement. From Wednesday, they're due to rise from 25 to 50% on steel and aluminium imports into the United States. Ralph Goodale has told Matt it'll impact both the Canadian and American steel industry if it goes ahead.
Last time, when the United States imposed steel and aluminium tariffs back in 2018-2019, the cost for defending each one of those steel jobs was $650,000 per job. And on the other side of the equation, the Americans lost 75,000 manufacturing jobs.
And records released by Buckingham Palace reveal details of gifts given to the royal family between 2020 and 2023. King Charles received a Rolls-Royce car for his coronation by the King of Bahrain, while the late Queen Elizabeth was given a cobble from the original set of Coronation Street during a visit in 2021. LBC weather. Showers will linger across the north of England and Wales before clearing later, dry with sunny spells elsewhere. Highs of 26 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
As you fan yourself with the menu, you ponder why you went for the vindaloo. Every wave of the specials ruffles the delicate ruffles of your red ruffled top. And as water runs down your chin, the waitress stares on. She just can't take her eyes off you. the masterpiece in the flowing scarlet skirt.
Enjoying your meal?
So much.
No sweat. Whatever happens, style it out. F&F.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Matt Fry.
Whenever we talk about defence, at the moment at least, we have to, you know, be very aware of the fact that, you know, there are real implications to our defence policy because there are real wars taking place as we speak and there are very real threats on the horizon. Now, the government on Monday will announce the results of its defence review. Britain is facing, it will say, a new era of threat with drones, artificial intelligence and other technologies, changing the nature of warfare more fundamentally than at any point in history, it'll say. Now, are they up to the challenge? We know about the increase in defence spending announced by this government, 2.5% rising to 3% in a few years' time. But it's not just about percentages of GDP. It's about what you spend that money on, how many troops you employ, what kind of tasks they will be given, and essentially whether we are up to these threats, some of them real, some of them imagined, but in a very plausible way, that are on the horizon. To discuss this, I'm joined by Mike Martin, Liberal Democrat MP for Tunbridge Wells. He's also a member of both the Defence Select Committee and the Joint Committee on National Security Strategy, and Robert Fox, Defence Editor of the London Evening Standard. Let's go to you first, Mike, and welcome to the programme. From what you've heard and read about this defence review and its results to be published on Monday, are you satisfied that it is up to what it says on the tin, a historic review of our defence capabilities?
I think the government's missing a trick, actually. I mean, I have no privileged access. The Defence Select Committee wasn't given an advanced copy, which is a bit odd in itself. But from what we've seen, the government seems to be trialling lots of high-tech solutions. And that's all well and good. But the problem is you have a big choice to make when you're spending lots of money on defence. And that is, do you go for a high-tech force or do you go for a larger force? I mean, obviously, you know, there's shades of grey in between the two, but that's your big dichotomy. And what clearly they've opted to do with announcements around Cyber Command and, you know, new digital backbone and all the rest of it is go long on the tech. But the problem is at the moment that the British military is tiny. It's the smallest it's been. You know, the infantry is the smallest it's been since the 1790s. We can put about 5 ships to sea at a time. Maybe if we had to fight tonight, we could get 30 planes in the air. It's just not big enough. So you can have that digital backbone that enables your forces to speak to each other with AI and all the rest of it. But if there aren't any forces to speak to each other, it doesn't amount to a hill of beans. That's the big problem. And that's the thing that the government has swerved in this defence review.
I think at the moment we have fewer than 80,000 men and women under arms. How many do you think we should have?
I think, and the Liberal Democrats have been arguing for quite a long time now, that the first thing we need to do is reverse the cuts that the Conservatives put to the army. So that's an extra 10,000. And we need to work out an ambition to get it above 100,000.
And when's the last time it was above 100,000?
Oh, when I was in the army 10 years ago, it was above 100,000. Mm.
Robert Fox, is this review up to what it's supposed to be up to?
I think it's that ghastly expression, a roadmap. It's been done by an external panel, but it's all Ministry of Defence material. It's saying this is what the proposition is, this is what the threat is, this is what we think we have to do, and this is a desirable way. Mike is absolutely right. The problem is personnel, and they're ducking it to some extent. Recruiting is very difficult until very recently, and I haven't checked the figures, forgive me, but up until a month or so ago, more were leaving the RAF. I think almost all 3 armed services were actually joining. Mm. There are ways that you can deal with that, but they're not responding to the changing shape of British society, which is in common with all developed societies. Aging population, the process of aging has some kinds of effects, which we've seen catalyzed by COVID. Young people are more reluctant to go to work full time. Young people are even more reluctant to go into public service. That's what you've got to address. And the overall phenomenon in a broad package, and I was hoping I was going to read a paragraph, and there certainly won't be one in the forthcoming defence review on what's known as this ghastly word, demographic wintering.
Mm.
I said to John Healy the other day, on Wednesday, I said, Secretary of State, what are your considerations in this exercise and what you're doing about recruiting of the ageing embraced by the term demographic wintering? John Healy and one of his officials said to me they'd never heard of the expression.
Mm.
Well, somebody's not doing the reading in the research department in the defence ministry. Mm. So people are going to be a problem. I think I'd like to pick up quickly from something Mike said. I fear it's going to be like the goddess Kali, you know, arms all over the place. It's going to be all things to all women and men, and probably not have a main sense of direction. I know what George Robertson, who was the architect of it, really wanted to do is that we are in an era, as Mike said, of growing danger, growing threat, and in the qualified modern terms, we are actually at war.
Okay.
And the government have had it very difficult to take that on board.
And of course, that sounds very scary, although it is also very accurate. Mike Martin, how does one persuade young men and women to join the armed forces when they don't even want to show up for work 5 days a week?
You know, I think, Rob and I agree on lots of things and have done for many years, but I think actually I would probably take issue with that. The armed forces are suffering from recruitment problems, but I don't think that's because of the lack of moral fibre in the current generation. I mean, every generation says that the previous generation, the forthcoming generation, doesn't have the moral fibre. And they said that when I was in Afghanistan, and I worked with 18-year-olds who, I will tell you, they had moral fibre as they went out searching for IEDs. I think the problem with recruitment, if I may, when it comes to the armed forces, is that there is, and this is what Rob said, there's a lack of purpose. Right. There's this view that the world is very dangerous, but it's not focused. We're sending our carrier group over to the Pacific, but actually Russia's the greatest threat. And that lack of strategy and purpose, you know, this is a strategic defense review without strategy, really, coupled with very underfunded military, means that it's just not an enticing career prospect.
But I mean, the Prime Minister has been very clear when he says this is a generational challenge. You know, Russia's war with Ukraine may not be contained in Ukraine. Sure. It might go beyond those borders.
Mm-hmm.
What should the government be saying about focusing that threat that they're not saying?
Okay, so if this is a generational challenge, then why is it that we are only increasing defence spending by 0.2% of GDP by 2027, and then we're hoping to get up to 3% by 2034, 9 years' time? Yeah. The world will
not enough.
Utterly... far too little, far too late. The rhetoric does not match the action. It's talk and not trousers.
Mm. Okay, I see that you're nodding, Robert Fox, talk and not trousers. But it's not, as I said earlier, it's not just the percentage of GDP that you're spending, it's what you're spending it on. So what should they spend the money on?
Well, they've got to get that sorted out. They are going to appoint, they've post-announced this new job, as Mike knows, of National Armaments Director. They still haven't got somebody to do it.
But what does that even mean, that job?
Well, he or she will oversee the whole business of buying kit and buying into the armed services, which has been a train crash. It's been a train crash almost as long as I have been a defence correspondent. And I think that this is something like my sixth, seventh or eighth defence review that's coming up. And Mike is absolutely right. The lack of focus, you can see it in their approach to recruiting. What have they done about recruiting? They've contracted it out. They've given it to private companies, and then they didn't like one private company that was doing it, so they've given it to another. Here's a funny thing. That second one that now has got it has taken the personnel from the other one. It is this lack of drive and purpose. And look at the way this thing is going to be announced on Monday. The Prime Minister is going to Scotland, I think, to some industrial and military site, because he wants to persuade his Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, that really this is a glorious job creation scheme.
Mm.
Lack of focus again.
So it's about growth, not guns.
They're going to be asked for a lot more contribution by NATO. That's the shock. The deadline is, as Mike knows, the 24th, 25th June, the NATO summit. And the NATO summit, we're going to hear Europe and NATO with less America. And there were Britain, France, Germany and Italy to lead. And if you're going to lead without a hands-on from America, you're going to need a lot more money. Rutte is already talking about minimum 3.5% of GDP by the end of this decade, and probably it should go up. If the what's it does hit the air conditioning, 5% within a decade from now.
Okay. Mike Martin, I guess the problem for any, you know, democratically elected government is, you know, especially when, you know, the troops aren't massing on the coasts and, you know, we don't see, you know, Russian drones flying over our skies. The tricky thing is to persuade people that there is a threat, that they are going to be required to make a sacrifice without scaring the living daylights out of them for something that isn't imminent. So how do you get that right as a politician?
Yeah, I mean, you say there isn't an imminent threat. We have undersea cables being cut by Russian ships. We have, you know, Russian submarines around the British coast, and we have Russian aircraft skirting and occasionally breaching our airspace. If the war in Ukraine is wrapped up or dials down, then we have 1,000 British troops in Estonia, and the Baltic nations are likely to be the next on the list for Russia. So this idea of scaring people, I think actually we do need to have a very frank conversation with the British public. That idea of a national conversation is something that we talk about often on the Defence Select Committee, because without that national conversation, and this can only be led by the Prime Minister, without that national conversation, people won't realise that if we are going to spend this much more on defence, then maybe we need to spend less on other things, or perhaps there are other ways that we need to fund it. And the reason the Prime Minister is not leading that conversation is because he doesn't want to open up another front in the spending war. We all understand that money is short, but the thing about defence is it's not important until it's important, and then it's the most important thing, and we are at that stage now.
Robert?
It's more imminent and actual than you're painting it, Matt, and that is the message, particularly from George Robertson, supported by Fiona Hill. I thought Mike was going to say Marks and Spencer, Harrods, Co-op, the hacks. I was at the cyber center with Healy. They were talking about the ramping up this sort of stuff. Is that the attacks are constant, 90,000 a year at least, nearly 200, potentially absolutely lethal, could take down great chunks of government, particularly in the NHS. Where I think we're failing, and the messaging has been failing already, judging by your remarks and your attitude, is that they haven't got the message out. We're in this new kind of strange hybrid war, and it's going to be relentless. And Fiona Hill, great expert on Russia particularly, and it's not exclusively Russia because we've got Iran, crime, small terrorist groups, and China, a very big one behind it. It is here and now, and it's going to get worse.
But you don't have to convince me, Robert, but you've got to convince, you know, people like my children that they are, you know, that it's worth...
But that's why I'm talking to you. I don't think you're doing a good enough job.
That's the last time I've got you on the programme. Robert Fox, Mike Martin, thank you very much to both of you for coming on. After the break, we're going to talk about Reform UK and whether they're up to the job. You know, they keep saying they're ready for government, and another 3.5 years before the next general election. They've actually got local government in their remit now. They're running local councils, so let's see how that's going on. And they have a plan for trying to fix the fiscal hole that this country is in. But does that plan add up to anything? And I say this because the Prime Minister, yet again in the last few days, said that the Tories, the Her Majesty's loyal opposition, the party that was in power for 14 years, is, you know, staring at down the barrel of a gun, looking into the abyss, and faces extinction. What do the Tories need to do in order to prevent that? And is Reform UK in any position at all to take over from them? 0345 6060 973. I'm Matt Fry. This is LBC. The time is now 11:17.
This is LBC.
How do you grow a perfectly sweet strawberry? Well, it takes more than just soil and water, but time, care, and the best conditions to flourish. At Tesco, we keep every strawberry warm during the day and cold during the night to ensure they develop the sweetest flavour. It may seem like a little thing, but to us, it's everything. Now, if you don't mind, the strawberries are sleeping. Tesco, every little helps.
The Red Cross is here to deliver essentials to people who have lost everything in Ukraine.
We are here to support families enduring the food crisis in Somalia.
We're here to shelter earthquake survivors in Turkey and Syria.
We're here for humanity. With your support, the Red Cross has helped millions of people in the UK and 190 other countries. Search British Red Cross to support us. Together, we are the world's emergency responders.
Car owners, you could be owed thousands in compensation. If you bought a car on finance from 2007 onwards, it may have been sold with hidden commissions. Text CLAIM to 86688. My Claim Group. Authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. You don't need to use a CMC. You can claim direct to your lender and the Financial Ombudsman for free. Text CLAIM to 86688.
Claims made simple.
Hey, Harry.
Hello, mate.
Got any tips for the football?
Your best bet is to head over to BetVictor. They're giving new customers a terrific welcome offer. If you bet a minimum of £10, they'll give you £30 in free bets.
Oh, that's a steal of a deal.
It's a good darn deal that'll make you squeal for real. Neil?
My name's not Neil.
I know, but it rhymes.
Listen to Harry and make your best bet on the football at BetVictor. 18 plus, opt in and bet on any football marketing at odds of evens or greater. No cash out, 7-day expiry. Terms and conditions apply. Gambleaware.org.
This is LBC with Matt Fry.
So we focus so much on, you know, politics in the United States and China and the wars in Europe and, you know, Gaza, of course, that we forget sometimes at our peril, you know, the domestic political landscape, which is also in flux. It is changing quite dramatically. You've got the Prime Minister just this week saying that the Tories are staring into the abyss, the party's facing extinction. You've got the Tories behaving sometimes as if they are indeed facing extinction. We're going to be talking to Geetu Hari, former advisor to Boris Johnson, in a few minutes. But what about Reform UK? They are obviously the new arrival. I mean, not that new, but they are the new force on the scene, you know, messing with people's assumptions, rearranging the furniture. They had an extraordinary success in the local and the council elections not so long ago. They're now actually in charge of councils. And as people look to them as potentially forming a future government, they want to know, how's that going to work out? How's it going to work out for our money, for the, you know, the pounds in our pockets? You know, would they be able to come up with some kind of economic plan that is different to what we've had so far? You've got Nigel Farage parking his tanks on just about everyone's lawn. There he is suggesting that they should do something that Labour hasn't yet embraced, which is to scrap the two-child cap on benefits. They've also said they would raise the limit on when income tax kicks in from 12,700 quid at the moment to £20,000. It begs the question, does any of this add up? And of course, they want it to add up because they want to be seen as a responsible potential party of government. Here to discuss all this is Gawain Toler, former advisor to Nigel Farage while he was leader of Reform UK, the Brexit Party and UKIP. And kind of just the fact that he's Nigel Farage has been in charge of three different entities,
yep,
and now in charge of Reform UK, it kind of, it's both the opportunity and the peril of Reform, isn't it? This is a, you know, this is a party based essentially, although you have six MPs now, around one man, isn't it?
No. I mean, given that Richard Tice had taken the party to 12 to 14% before the general election, and this is from a standing start, I think it'd be unfair to suggest that it's all about Nige. However, yes, of course, I mean, this is, love him or loathe him, Nigel Farage is the predominant politician.
Is he like being called Nige?
I don't know. But you get my point.
Right,
he has been an extraordinary figure in British politics. He had the impact of forcing a referendum when he wasn't even elected. And now he's in. And
is that the problem for him as well? That now that he's in, now that you've got councillors, you know, running councils, you know, now that they want to, you don't want to have not just the power of the pulpit, but the power of actually doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where you might come unstuck?
No, I actually think knowing a lot of the councillors and talking to them, they are looking forward to the job. Yes, there's going to be more scrutiny. Good. Because without that scrutiny, the people of this country won't trust us when it comes to the big game, which is in 4 years' time.
Mm-hmm.
We have to prove ourselves. And to prove ourselves requires us to do stuff and do it effectively. And that gives us an opportunity. If we didn't have those councils, if we don't have that scrutiny, how are people going to trust us when it comes to the next general election? It is essential.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, you've been putting out some ideas about how you would structure a budget. And correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I understand, Reform's big idea is that you would scrap the net zero policy.
We think that the climate change agenda is a disaster.
And that would save you how many billions?
We reckon between 40 and 50, depending on...
40 and 50 billion.
Yes, but That is the top line stuff.
Yeah.
But by doing that, you also improve the economy. You also cut the cost of living to ordinary people across the country. So it's not just the tax spend on climate change projects and things of that sort, but it also frees up the economy far more. It encourages investment in the country from abroad.
Mm.
Currently, if you're a company looking to invest it somewhere, why would you invest in the UK when the industrial cost of power is three times what it is next door in France? It doesn't work. So you have that $40 billion in non-spending of taxpayers' money, but you also have a vast improvement in the standard of living and various other things. So it's a double boon.
Critics of your budget plans have said that actually that figure of $40 and $50 billion that you would save from net zero is entirely unrealistic.
It
doesn't look at the amount of money that actually, you know, a greener economic policy would generate for the economy. So you're seeing it from one point of view and not from the other.
Well, I take your point, but I cordially disagree. I think that it does add up, and not only that, this so-called green economy doesn't work. It actually isn't working. The only way it works is through more taxpayer subsidies.
Well, look at renewable energy. I mean, our energy costs are very high, but, you know, we generate on some days as much as 75% of our energy through wind farms. You're going to get rid of those?
But they're up there already, but I wouldn't be building new ones. And yes, you're right, one or two days a year, you may be on that point. But for a lot of the time, you have to have reserve power, reserve capacity, because they don't. Sometimes it doesn't run. And when it comes to solar arrays, apart from Ireland, we are the worst country in the world when it comes to using solar arrays for generating energy. It works maybe in South Australia, superb, but it doesn't work in our cloudy little wet island that we love so much. So,
what about migrant hotels? So you're going to save a lot of money by basically kicking people, asylum seekers who are living in migrant hotels, out of those hotels.
You have to change the incentive structure when it comes to migration.
Just about the money, first of all, how much will that save you or save the British economy?
Honestly, I don't have those figures in front of me. I'm not the guy that
I just wonder if it's enough. I mean, migrant hotels are expensive, we all know that.
Yes,
and it's a number that people are very upset about, because they think, why should these migrants or asylum seekers live in hotels at all? But it's not going to plug the fiscal hole, is it? It's just not
on its own. But we're starting to see reform. We do have 4 years before the next election. Nobody produces a manifesto until the election takes place. But we're starting to see some points of principle. I'm describing it like you see the peaks of a range of mountains. And as the cloud descends, you start to see the foothills and how it all structures. But right now, you're seeing some peaks of policy. It will take a long time, and we have a lot of work to do for those peaks to become that range. Absolutely.
But I wonder if the real peaks that you're looking at and that you're good at are the peaks of the culture wars. You know, you're good at fighting culture wars. That's really what you've been doing for a very long time, and fighting the kind of the hard battle of actually organising government, making economic numbers add up. That's much more difficult, isn't it? And far less sexy, if you like.
Of course it's more difficult. And I know that we're now looking at the sheer, pensions. Nobody's prepared to seriously look at the whole pension problem. We haven't come with solutions, but I know that that is something that we're looking at very, very closely. Because this is something, the unfunded pension schemes of this country are terrifying. And that has to be addressed. But it's interesting. You have a Labour front bench where nobody has ever worked in creating new business. Nobody has ever been responsible for payroll. Nobody has done that. And in reform, you have a lot of people who've set up their own business and worked and have had to deal with all that stuff. So, honestly,
yeah, there are plenty of people in the Tory front bench who've done exactly that and have done it for years.
I would trust reforms people over Labour 100 times, just because they have had to do these.
But the accusation levelled against your party is that you are setting yourself up and Britain up, should you get into government, for another Liz Truss moment. Unfunded tax cuts, pie in the sky stuff.
This is the
reality of the markets.
This is the sort of Starmer attack lines.
But it's a fair point, isn't it?
No, I don't think it
Why
is.
Why should we there trust are, you are, over the Tories when it comes to economic competence?
Initially, exactly as I was saying earlier, first you look at how we actually operate in power, which is in those councils and these things. See, are we competent? And I don't think those councils need necessarily to be brilliant. They just need to be competent and effective.
Mm.
Nobody's expecting a moon on a stick. Everybody knows the country's in all sorts of trouble. There is no silver bullet. There's no magic mountain. You have to do what you can with the situation you've got.
Mm.
But there are some principles here. And I think that when you've got a government that first invents a black hole of 22 billion, then we've discovered it's 35 billion. They are making an absolute kibosh of so many levels. And for those people to say, oh, but you can't trust those reformers because they're competent, well, they're clearly not.
And when it comes to comparing yourself to the Tory party, what have you got that the Tories don't have?
Conviction and 14 years of not ruining the country, not lying to the country every single election. That's what we've got. The Tory party are clearly at sixes and sevens.
Okay, so one of the big things the Tory party did was to give the country a referendum on joining the European Union. You don't seem to mention Brexit very much these days. Well, is that because 56% of the public now think it was a bad idea?
No, not at all. It's because we actually had the Brexit. I love it.
But has it worked out for the country?
In many ways, I think it has. Wait.
Yeah. Just on Brexit, I'm just curious. Yeah. Give me some practical examples that have made the vote worthwhile. Where have we benefited from Brexit?
Oh, there's all sorts of abilities to do trade deals and things like this, which we've been doing, which we couldn't do. Famously, when it came to the vaccinations, we were able to do things. We were able to act on Ukraine faster than our friends on the continent. But the point about Brexit...
That's all nonsense, isn't it?
No,
I mean, we could have done a vaccine programme even had we been members of the European Union.
The French particularly were trying to steal our vaccines. That's not true.
Give me something credible and concrete where thing that you care about most, which is Brexit, has actually worked for the country.
Well, the thing I care about on Brexit, and I do, and I believe it's the right thing, and I'm perfectly happy with how it's gone so far. I wish it'd been better. I wish we'd have a government that actually believed in it when it went to negotiations. Mm. The negotiations were done very poorly.
Yeah,
I agree. I'm not going to deny that. However, to me, it's about democracy. That's why I was involved. You can sack the boss. To go into a dynamic alignment, as Starmer's just done with on a whole series of policies, means that we don't get to decide what happens to us. That, to me, is wrong. Wrong.
If we get to decide what happens to us, but we decide it in the way that North Korea does, for instance, we end up being poorer, what's the point? I mean...
Hold on. Are you saying that democracy...
Democracy is great, but we also want to have prosperity.
Yes, of course we do, but the whole point is, the whole point was, if the country had wanted to vote for Corbyn, it could.
And so better to be free from Brussels and poor than to be slightly less free of Brussels but more prosperous.
Better to be free to make our own decisions, and when our politicians get it wrong, to be able to sack them. Yes.
But you can do that.
You can't, because whilst a member of the European Union, you do not make the final decision. Mm. Foreign court makes
decisions. Well, it's a collective thing, isn't it? I mean,
yes, but it's not us. It's not democracy.
Well, it's diluted, right?
You know, sovereignty is the zero-sum game. You've got it or you're not.
But hang on a second. So, you know, there is no such thing as pure sovereignty. We're finding that out with Donald Trump at the moment.
But we can make decisions about how to respond to things. We can't do as a member of the European Union.
But those decisions have costs, don't they?
Of course, so we can decide to turn our backs
on
costs.
Well, exactly. So we can decide to turn our backs on Donald. We can turn our back on Donald Trump, you know, and say we don't need a trade deal with the US because they're being far too mercurial about it all, but we're going to be poorer as a result. Are we prepared to do that?
If I walk out my front door, I can turn left or turn right.
We decided to leave the European Union. That was our decision.
Precisely.
But was it the wise decision?
I believe so, because it gives us those freedoms and liberties.
Okay. I'm always amazed that these days when you talk to, you know, your lot, Reform UK, even the Tories, the Tory lot, the lots, you know, when you talk to political parties, you know, you really have to tease the Brexit word out of them because no one wants to talk about it.
I'm so proud of it.
Having brought it up. Okay. All right. We're going to leave it there. Thank you very much, Need, for coming in. I'm Matt Fry. This is LBC. The time at 11:33. It's time for the news with Dominic Ellis.
Two adults and a teenager have died following a car crash on the M5 in South Gloucestershire last night. A second child has been seriously hurt after a BMW left the northbound carriageway near to Michaelwood Services. The government says it's working with the United States to clarify the implications of its latest steel and aluminium import tariffs. Donald Trump says he's doubling the tax on the metal imports to 50% on Wednesday. And a team of international scientists say they've made a breakthrough in the treatment of some head and neck cancers. A trial tested the immunotherapy drug pembrolizumab that kept the cancers at bay for 5 years compared to 30 months with standard care. LBC weather, showers for northern England and Wales continuing before clearing later, dry with sunny spells elsewhere, highs of 26 degrees.
This is LBC.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. Holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Next time you walk their dog or feed their cat, when you pop by for a cuppa or just stop for a chat, tell your friends about pension credit. They could be missing out on an average of over £4,000 per year to boost their pension income. Pension credit also unlocks other support like help with heating costs, council tax, and a free TV licence for people over 75. Tell them to search for pension credit on gov.uk. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
How would you like to be a Win Plus winner? Enter now to win huge cash prizes and loads more at winplus.co.uk. 18 plus, GB only, T's and C's apply.
With Lidl Plus Fruity Super Spin, simply shop and spin to win a free fresh fruit coupon with every shop. Download the Lidl Plus app to get by switching to the Retail Industry Awards Fresh Produce Retailer of the Year. 18 plus GB residents, various prizes available, subject to availability. Ends 4th of the 625. Full T's and C's apply. See lidl.co.uk/spin.
The Virgin Atlantic holiday sale is now on. This is your sign to taste Jamaican jerk chicken so good it brings a tear to your eye. Catch a New York basement gig worth the 10-block detour. Or hit the dunes in Dubai and find sand in your pockets for weeks. Seize the sale. Book in store or online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Selected routes. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com.
This is LBC with Matt Fry. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So we're talking about Reform UK and whether they're up to forming the next government, should we get there in 3.5 years' time, and to what extent they are in a position to replace the Tories. The Prime Minister spent an awful lot of time attacking Reform UK and not the Tory party, who are still Her Majesty's loyal opposition. So we'll talk about the Tory identity crisis in a minute with Gitu Hari, but let's just go to Daniel in Golders Green on Reform. Daniel, you're on the air.
Good morning, Matt. I'm sure it will come as no surprise to you or your listeners that I genuinely believe Reform has what it takes to form the next government. When you look at the team that they have, you've got Nigel Farage, who worked in the metals business. You've got Richard Tice, who was a former home builder. Sarah Poaching was a former magistrate. Lee Anderson was a former miner. They've got a 28-page fully costed policy document with brilliant ideas on how to help the lowest paid earners, lift them out of income tax, help boost defence spending, boost criminal justice spending. They've got some really good ideas, Matt.
Right. And why would you vote for them or advocate their ideas rather than the Tories' ideas?
Brilliant question. Two reasons. I used to vote Tory and they utterly, utterly betrayed me. I voted for the Conservatives because I thought they were going to cut taxes. They didn't. They raised taxes to the highest level in 80 years. I voted for the Conservatives because I thought they were the decent people in the room, and they viciously and savagely went after entrepreneurs, unpaid carers, frontline doctors and nurses, the Windrush generation. They betrayed everyone in this country, Matt. So I trust Reform because they talk common sense, and I believe that they genuinely believe in what they say.
What about the Labour Party currently in government? They say they're very much on the side of business. That's how they're trying to, you know, kickstart, you know, or rather reboot growth in this country. Do you believe them?
Don't believe a single word of it, Matt. I think it's left-wing propaganda from them. You listen to Keir Starmer say he's on the side of businesses and working people, yet we've seen 220,000 businesses go bankrupt. We've seen 100,000 job losses. We've seen the government borrow £20 billion alone last month and £152 billion in the last year. Keir Starmer also, Matt, he completely reneged on his promises, the freeze council tax, the freeze energy bills to help the WASPI women. He has gone back on every pledge he's ever made, and you cannot trust a single word he says.
When's the last time you voted Tory, by the way, Daniel?
in 2015.
Okay, all right. Daniel in Golders Green, thanks very much indeed. Well, let's bring in Geeta Hari, former Downing Street Director of Communications, while Boris Johnson was Prime Minister. Geeta, it's good to have you back on the programme.
Always good to be here.
When you hear someone like Daniel, a former Tory voter, saying that, you know, he's lost confidence in the Tory party, you know, they've gone against all the principles that they once espoused, that they promised, etc., etc., does that worry you as someone who used to work for the Tory government?
It's interesting that his attack seems to be from the left. He's attacking the Conservatives for not spending more on welfare. And this has been the breakthrough development this week.
But he's also attacking them on taxes, isn't he? He's saying that, you know, the Tory government's, successive Tory governments raised taxes on a whole number of issues.
And they've gone up even further since Labour took over. So it's not like there was an option of charging less taxes. The reason taxes were high under the Conservatives was because we spent £400 billion locking down the country during a global pandemic. I was hesitant about that, indeed, you know, mildly opposed to it, but not many people were. So I don't think there are many votes in sort of revisiting that one. What's interesting now is this week, Nigel Farage, having been, you know, attacking the Conservatives until now, has just made £50 to £80 billion worth of spending commitments, which puts him to the left of Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
And if that's where people want to go, good luck to them. But I don't think that's a good prescription for the UK. So I think this week has been very interesting because at last we are starting to see more than the sort of jolly chap that we'd all enjoy to have a pint with in the pub and starting to see the reality of reform. And the reality is not impressive.
But the main criticism against reform's spending plans, which is that they're basically, you know, unfunded tax cuts, essentially, pie in the sky stuff. The most trenchant things you can say about them is that they are, you know, a revisitation of Liz Truss. Now, Liz Truss may only have been Prime Minister for, 44 days, but she was a Tory Prime Minister. And is that still your biggest problem? That the party that is supposed to embody economic managerial competence did exactly the opposite, especially under her prime ministership, and that is still the shadow that hangs over you?
Well, I think it's tragic, but the Conservative Party, without doubt, particularly the Parliamentary Conservative Party, lost its way. It lost its sense of purpose. It lost its nerve. It toppled the most successful election-winning leader that it had had in 40 or 50 years and chose Liz Truss in its place. So there's a whole load of things. And since then, you know, I think the Tory party's gone off in a direction where it's trying to be a poor man's reform, or should we say a rich man's reform. Mm. It's trying to be reform light. It's imitating Nigel Farage without the charisma and the sense of drive and authenticity. So I think it's been a bad few years for the Conservative Party, to be honest. But now the challenge is largely for Labour to see off, you know, a reform that is actually parked on its lawn, and for the Conservative Party, inshallah, as we say, Matt, to sort of see that there is a sensible space at the sweet spot near the centre of British politics where the Conservative Party has always been when it's been one of the most successful election-winning forces in the history of democracy.
Okay, talking of inshallah, of you being in this extraordinary, you know, political machine that keeps winning elections, you've got Robert Jenrick, who may one day become Tory leader, perhaps sooner than we might think, is spending his recess time off picking on fare dodgers while filming himself. I mean, is this really the way to capture the hearts and minds of the nation? Come on.
It reminded me of a young reporter at the BBC called Matt Fry, who was very good at the...
We didn't have cell phones in those days. I never did that kind of stuff.
I think it was a great piece of reportage. And I have to say, I'm not his biggest fan, I think, in a way.
A great piece of reportage? Come on. We're talking about someone who might want to be Prime Minister one day. This is ridiculous.
Well, you know, I'm choosing my words carefully here. So I'll do it the other way around then. I'm no fan of Robert Jenrick. I'm no fan of Kemi Badenoch. I think their prescription of what went wrong and what is needed for the Conservative Party is fundamentally flawed. They think that we need to imitate reform. We do not need to imitate reform. We need to rediscover what we stand for. However, as an isolated incident, I do think that highlighting some of the very basic things that are wrong with modern Britain that are overlooked, and fare dodging is one of them. Shoplifting is another. The fact that people are openly selling drugs on the street, that any person landing from Mars could discover who the drug dealers were within 5 seconds. There's so much that's wrong. And I think credit to him on that particular issue for highlighting it.
I guess the problem is that, you know, your former boss, Boris Johnson, led the Tory party down a populist route, like him or loathe him, that is a, you know, that has ended up where we are at the moment, where you are at the moment, which is a party that, forgive me, I think sort of lost its soul or direction. Do you represent, you know, the voters, you know, middle class property owning voters of the southeast? Do you represent, you know, working class voters who voted for Brexit of the northwest or the northeast? Where exactly does the Tory party reside these days? Because frankly, I haven't got a clue.
Well, it's a good question. And the sad thing for me is that the focus has been over the last 18 months in particular. And this is why Robert Jenrick, if he were to replace Kemi, would not improve on this situation, has all been on how to imitate reform. I'm speaking to you from the Cotswolds, and you used to sort of drive from London to the Cotswolds, and it was all blue territory. That's all gone, not to Nigel Farage. All of this, you know, beautiful landscape around here, all these villages, all these towns, most of them are now in the hands of the Liberal Democrats. There are two ways of losing votes as a Conservative Party, and they've taken every single eye in the party off the sort of flank that is hemorrhaging to the Lib Dems. So back to Boris, though, he assembled, which is always what's necessary to win an election convincingly, with millions more votes, by the way, than Keir Starmer secured last year, a broad coalition that included the Tory shires, that included working class people who wanted...
But that's because of the force of his personality. That's because of his particular personality.
No, you look at some of the policies, Matt. There were plans there to build nuclear power plants by the end of the decade so we didn't have another cost of living crisis. There were plans to build hospitals. There was a massive commitment to net zero that everybody seems to have dropped since. It was a genuine thing from Boris, and people who are environmentally sort of conscious and sincere will acknowledge that it's been a backward step. HS2 was something he was committed to. It was cancelled by Rishi Sunak. There was a whole load
of... But where was the follow-up in all that stuff? Right, because, you know, if I cast my mind back to the Boris Johnson government, it was like chucking spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks.
Not at all. There was a manifesto that was, you know, at the top of it was something I disagree with fundamentally, which was to take the UK out of the European Union. He promised that. People voted for him. He delivered it. That's a big promise kept. I wish he hadn't done it in many ways because I disagreed with the decision. But a majority of people in Britain wanted that. He delivered that. Then we hit a global pandemic.
He pledged to build 40 new NHS hospitals by 2030. You know, and how many did he actually build?
Well, what happened in the meantime, Matt? What happened in the meantime was not some sort of minor diversion. What happened in the meantime was a global pandemic that shut down the economy, that put us $400 billion in debt and actually overwhelmed the NHS. The NHS heroically...
But other countries have come out of the pandemic.
But the idea of moving
forward... Yeah, but other countries... You can't use the pandemic as a constant excuse. I mean, other countries in Europe,
and
especially the United States, have come out of the pandemic, you know, roaring. But their economy's roaring.
In 5 years' time, the impact of the pandemic will not actually be less in real time just because we're looking at it with more distance. The impact was very, very real, and it sabotaged the plans. But had the Tory party not toppled Boris Johnson when they did, he was desperate that summer to get back on track, to get back into sort of delivering on the manifesto promises that he'd made and get the economy purring again.
Right. Purring. Okay, just on talking of purring, and finally and briefly, Gitu, there are rumours that he might be coming back into politics, into the House of Commons, that he'll inherit a safe Tory seat somewhere. Can you confirm those rumours or dispel them?
I don't think it's going to happen. I think the breakdown in the relationship between him and the Conservative Party was pretty bad, and on both sides, there will be... It would be a very, very difficult relationship to try and rekindle.
Will Boris Johnson join Reform UK?
No, I don't think, A, there's room for him and Nigel Farage in the same party. I think Nigel Farage would not want him there, and he's a Conservative through and through. So it's a tragedy that the Conservative Party toppled him, but, you know, one of the most talented people in modern public life is currently out of public life. Mm. And the private sector enjoying his talents, you know, he's writing, but unfortunately the Conservative Party actually toppled him, and they're paying the price for it now.
And remind us just briefly, what is the difference between Reform UK and the Tory party?
There are huge differences, and this week Nigel Farage has just made them more obvious. He's just said that he'd like to spend $80 billion more than Keir Starmer, whereas the Conservatives traditionally, they had to spend a lot of money during a pandemic, but in generally, under virtually every Conservative government, taxes have been lower and the economy has been in better shape. And unemployment has been lower at the end of a Conservative government than at the end of Labour governments.
Get your hurry. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. After the break, the Bank of England governor, Lilith, has urged deeper ties with the EU to minimise the Brexit impact. There we are again, the B word. We'll be speaking to Professor Catherine Barnard. I'm Matt Fry. This is LBC. The time is 11:48.
Coming up at 12 on LBC, Ali Miraj.
The Attorney General is facing a backlash after lamenting calls to disengage from the ECHR and other international bodies as akin to an approach pursued by Nazi Germany. Should he be sacked?
Ali Miraj on LBC.
Next time you walk their dog or feed their cat, when you pop by for a cuppa or just stop for a chat, tell your friends about pension credit. They could be missing out on an average of over £4,000 per year to boost their pension income. Pension credit also unlocks other support like help with heating costs, council tax, and a free TV licence for people over 75. Tell them to search for pension credit on gov.uk. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
With Little Plus Fruity Super Spin, simply shop and spin to win a free fresh fruit coupon with every shop. Download the Little Plus app to get by switching to the Retail Industry Awards Fresh Produce Retailer of the Year. 18 plus GB residents, various prizes available, subject to availability. Ends 4th of the 6/25. Full T's and C's apply. See little.co.uk/spin.
Looking for a fun-filled day out this spring? The O2 has it all. Catch the latest blockbuster at Cineworld or challenge your friends with interactive football at Toca Social. Take on darts, mini golf and more at Boom Battle Bar. Get active with a game of paddle tennis, climb to new heights or take flight with an indoor skydive at iFly. Feeling hungry? Choose from over 30 bars and restaurants and discover flavours from around the world. Search Do More at the O2 to start planning your perfect day.
Amazon offers employees up to £8,000 for education and training, like Juliet. She's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £8,000 for education and training at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
At Wickes, save on Dulux Standard 2.5 litre coloured emulsion. Was £23, now £15. Feel as proud as a peacock with Wickes. Ends Wednesday. Terms apply.
Matt Fry on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker now. Just say, play LBC.
We're going to talk about realignment with the EU in a minute. But first, let's go to Mike in Chesham on just about everything we've talked about in the last 2 hours. Mike, you're on the air.
Morning, Matt. First of all, I was a veteran, infantry veteran. I left in 2010. Mm-hmm. I went to the gym this morning and I was talking to a guy that left the army last week. He was a sergeant in the Grenadier Guards.
Yeah.
And he says, I wouldn't recognise the military nowadays. He says, morale's rock bottom, recruitment's out the window. 80% of the recruitment's now done in Commonwealth countries. So there's no point spending all this money to get all this new kit. Mm-hmm. But we haven't got people to use it. And we've also got to remember that our infantry numbers now are only at about 19,500, which is a joke, because the rest of the people are there to support the infantry.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to go to war, defend something, do anything, you're going to exhaust your resources within probably a year.
I think we've got more civil servants in the Ministry of Defence now than we have actual soldiers fighting, potentially.
100%. I think the other problem is with Conservative governments have not put any money into the military, and people just see how bad veterans have been treated, and then they think, well, why would we go into do that?
Mm.
And it's not just Labour, it's the Tory. It's been going on for decades, and they've been doing it on the cheap. There's always undercutting, always bad kit. We're borrowing kit. When I was used to be in Afghan, we'd be borrowing kit off other nations,
yeah.
Night vision stuff. Then you'd have to get the Sun and the Mail to do campaigns, and we'd get some new kit. So people have just been seeing this for years and years and years, and we've also got a lack of national pride. So people don't like, they think, why should we? A, they think it's a rubbish job, and then they think, why should we fight for the country?
But when you listen to the defence experts that we had on the programme earlier, they said it's not a question of national pride. It should be a question of national necessity. That's why people should want to join the armed forces, because we need the country to be protected in these dangerous times.
People don't think like that. They just think, if it was an attractive job, go back to basics, make it a good job. If you look, I watched a thing on Scandinavia this week. Finland, for instance, they got something like 900,000 troops because the majority reserve. Everyone wants to be involved in it. Everyone wants to.
But they do national service there, don't they? They have a very strict national service regime.
They have, but then they volunteer for afterwards, and they've got national pride. Mm. Like Poland, They've expanded their...
Well, they've got a national pride, but also they're right next... They share a 1,800-kilometre border with Russia. There's that minor matter.
I think they've got national pride. They want to be involved in it. They make it an attractive proposition, as where we're always trying to do things on the cheap.
Okay. All right, Mike, we're going to leave it there. Mike in Chesham, thanks very much for your call. Okay, let's talk about the EU then. Yes, the EU and Brexit and how to undo some of the damage or realise the opportunities afforded by the Brexit vote all those years ago. Andrew Bailey, the governor of the Bank of England, who has been reputed in the past to be a Brexiteer, although he denies that, he says he's apolitical when it comes to this question, says Brexit was not wrong, he said, but it welcomes the UK's efforts to reset relations with the bloc. Now, of course, Keir Starmer has done that to some extent. You know, there was the EU summit last week, I think it was, or maybe the week before, I can't remember exactly, where he and Ursula von der Leyen, you know, kind of set, you know, the new path of greater realignment when it comes to agricultural goods, when it comes to, you know, veterinary directives, when it comes to some limited freedom of movement, etc., etc. So there's fisheries, of course, there's a lot of stuff going on there. The question is it enough, and how far further could the government go before they have to open that whole can of worms with the great big letter B on it all over again? Let's go to Professor Catherine Barnard, Professor of European Union Law at the University of Cambridge, also a senior fellow of the UK in a Changing Europe think tank. Catherine, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So has Starmer gone far enough, you know, politically to kind of realign us? And I know that's realignment is a word that some people love and other people absolutely hate. Or can he go much further, and why is he not doing it?
So if you are in favour of the EU, you would say he's not gone anywhere near far enough because of his red lines. And his red lines are no access to single market, no customs unions, and no free movement of persons. And that really has constrained his freedom for manoeuvre. If you're a leaver, you'd say he's already sold us out because he has agreed to a limited amount of what's called dynamic alignment. And that's the jargon for keeping up with EU rules in certain areas. So probably he's gone more or less about as far as he can go within the constraints he's set himself. There are a couple of areas where he could go further, and these are really technical. I'll use a term that will lift your heart. It's called conformity assessment. Oh. Probably nobody has ever heard of conformity assessment, but
I think about it all the time. What is it?
I imagine you discussed it over breakfast. Conformity assessment is actually quite important for business because it's showing that British goods conform with EU standards. Now, at the moment, the EU insists that all the testing is done in the EU and not done in the UK, which adds significant cost to our business. Now, the EU has allowed, for example, Canada to have their testing centres test products for the EU market, but won't allow the same for the EU. Now, the problem is, as we've discovered from Brexit, there's a huge amount of technicality, underbelly that just kept the single market going, and we're outside that. Now, the other thing to say is the deal that was struck last week is essentially, in large part, an agreement to enter into further negotiations. It's not actually an agreement that is signed and sealed.
OK. Now, if you talk to a lot of businesses, especially smaller ones, they say that Brexit has landed them with a huge amount of red tape that makes it almost impossible for them to sell stuff in Europe. Has any of that red tape been reduced by the agreements made between Brussels and London last week?
Not yet. The main area where that red tape would be reduced is in respect of SPS, sanitary and phytosanitary. And those are the EU rules on plants, animals, things like that. Fisheries as well. Now, the problem is that the SPS agreement is not an agreement yet. It's only an agreement that we will carry on discussing, us joining some sort of SPS agreement with the EU. But when that is agreed, it will relieve a lot of the bureaucracy, not just on UK goods going into the EU, but it will also, I think, even potentially more importantly, reduce the friction on the GB Northern Ireland border.
I mean, it sounds as if we are going to be destined to an eternity of negotiations with the European Union, with one side saying we've gone too far and the other side saying we haven't gone far enough.
Yeah, I mean, it keeps people like me in business. But on the other hand, you're absolutely right. It is an ongoing process. Switzerland already knows this. Switzerland has 120 agreements with the EU and a somewhat difficult relationship with the EU. And the UK, as a geographically close and very important trading partner with the EU, will carry on having ongoing negotiations. You could say, depending on your point of view, Brexit is the gift that keeps on giving, or for your readers and listeners who may be somewhat exhausted by the whole thing, you ain't seen nothing yet.
In 10 seconds, Catherine, where has our economy benefited from Brexit?
It is quite hard to point to anything really substantive. Some of the leavers would say, look at the trade deals we've done with India and elsewhere, Australia, New Zealand. But in fact, they are only adding something about 0.1, 0.2% of GDP. Most people think that Brexit's cost our GDP somewhere between 4 and 5%. But a lot of people didn't vote for Brexit for that reason. They voted for Brexit because they wanted parliamentary sovereignty back.
Okay. Professor Catherine Barnard, thank you very much indeed for ending on such a clear note. I'm sure that is a conversation that's going to carry on and on and on. Thanks to all of you for listening, for writing in, for shouting at Alexa. I'm off now at 3 o'clock here on LBC. It's Vanessa Feltz, but up next, Ali Mirage.
Thank you very much, Matt. The Attorney General, Lord Hermer, is facing a cabinet backlash after lamenting calls to disengage from the ECHR and other international bodies if they no longer serve British interests as a pick-and-mix approach similar to the